Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as The New York Times, The News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website mentalfloss.com. Question number one, what is the name of the special tuba used by many marching bands today? Is that A, the sackbut, B, the mellophone, C, the sousaphone, or D, la brosson? Which of those is the special tuba used by marching bands? Question number two, the popular marching band trombone suicide routine is named for what? A, its tendency to cause injuries when performed. B, it was named for the high-strutting majorette who died of heat exhaustion during its execution. C, was named for the suspicious death of the trombonist composer of this song who suffered from severe depression. Or D, it's a sarcastic name for a standard movement by marching bands, since the actual routine only involves marching in place for a minute. The answers to these two important musical trivia questions, including this one on trombone suicide routines, will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today is the weekend of June the 7th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1982, that Elvis Presley's Graceland Mansion in Memphis, Tennessee, opened as a tourist attraction. 1982. And it was 26 years ago today, 1993, that the groundbreaking ceremony was held for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum in Cleveland, Ohio. 1993 today. And in country and folk music news, we have this article entitled, My List, Five Great Protest Anthems. This is written by Joan Baez, published in Rolling Stone magazine, June 2019 issue. The folk icon recently played the final American show of her farewell tour. She'll wrap it up in Madrid on July 28th at the Teatro Real. For traditional protest anthem, We Shall Overcome, the song playing in the background. This is probably the greatest protest song ever written, according to Joan Baez. It's a meeting of politics and social change and music. Then there's Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind. The message in this is universal. I've heard German boys singing it by a fire. It's an anthem. That's why so many people have latched on to it. John Lennon's Imagine. I sing this on my current tour. It has a beautiful lilt, and it's easy to sing. People feel at home and together when they sing along to it. Then there's Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer. This is a protest song, even though Paul wasn't political. I sing it right after Imagine, and it takes on a new meaning. Finally, Violeta Parra, Gracias a la Vida. Sung everywhere, there is a Latin American dictator. It could have been a song of outrage, but it's a song of thank you. And this, of course, has been Joan Baez performing We Shall Overcome in the background right now.
We are not afraid today. We are not afraid.
classical music news, we have this review of a podcast published in the Week magazine, May 31, June 7, 2019 issue. Decomposed, put out by American Public Media. The world of classical music has no shortage of juicy stories, said Jenny McGrath in DigitalTrends.com. This podcast series, hosted by concert pianist and storyteller Jade Simmons, probes the lives of great composers to illuminate their genius and how sometimes tumultuous private dramas colored their work. Think of it as Behind the Music, Classical Edition. Each episode is not just a history lesson. It's a narrative with a character arc, a protagonist, antagonists, a climax, a resolution, imagery, and a heavy dose of emotion, said Will Williams in AVClub.com. The first episode focuses on Clara Schumann, a brilliant pianist and composer who was overshadowed by her husband, Robert Schumann. And naturally, Decomposed scores its stories with gorgeous classical music. It's the perfect mix of drama and art. Some better-known composers get their due, too, said Sarah Larson in NewYorker.com. The Tchaikovsky episode, Why Did You Betray Me?, should be optioned as a miniseries because I want to watch it.
Back to my little grass shack in Kalakakua, Hawaii. I want to be with all the Connies and Wahinas that I knew long ago.
And in jazz music news, we have Leon Redbone with Ringo Starr singing My Little Grass Shack. And this is an obituary for Leon Redbone. 1949 to 2019. Idiosyncratic singer revived songs of an earlier time. This is written by Neil Genslinger, published in the New York Times, on the 1st of June, 2019. Leon Redbone, who burst into the pop music scene in the mid-1970s with a startling throwback singing style and a look to go with it, favoring songs from bygone eras, drolly delivered, died Thursday in Pennsylvania. He was 69. A specific cause of death was not given, but Redbone had retired from performing in 2015 because of ill health. Toting an acoustic guitar, his face generally half hidden by a Panama hat and dark glasses, Redbone channeled performers and songwriters from ragtime, Delta blues, Tin Pan Alley, and more. Material not generally heard by the rock generation. His music defied early classic categorization. He was sometimes described as a jazz singer, other times as a folk or pop or blues artist. He sang in a deep, gravelly voice that combined singing and mumbling.
It won't be long till my ship will be sailing back to Kona.
A grand old place that's always fair to see.
I'm just a little Hawaiian and a homesick island boy. I want to go back to my fishing port. I want to go back to my little grass shack.
Leon Redbone. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled The Noises We Try Not to Hear. And this is published by Hui Su on the 31st of May, 2019 in The New Yorker. As the world gets louder, we combat sound with more sound, searching for an illusion of control. As far as Guinness Book of World Records is concerned, the quietest place on Earth belongs to Microsoft. On their Redmond, Washington campus, the company has built a room cocooned in concrete and steel, resting atop a bed of vibration-dampening springs. Microsoft uses the room to test how loud a component, such as the clicker on a mouse, really is. Microsoft's echo-free chamber is minus 20 decibels. As the negative in that number suggests, the quietness of the room is literally at a level beyond human perception. There are days when sitting in a room that noiseless sounds appealing, but some people are so unaccustomed to such levels of quiet that, after just a few minutes inside the chamber, they become disoriented. Hundraj Gopal, the room's principal designer, says that some find the room deafening, that it brings a sense of fullness in the ears. Standing in the room, you hear the unbearable noise of your heartbeat, your breath, the churning of your stomach. You grow too conscious of your own thoughts, your own body, the passage of time. I thought about these echoless chambers while reading Hush, Media and Sonic Self-Control by the scholar and musician Mac Haygood. Haygood's wide-ranging book considers orphic media, or tools that give listeners the power to be unaffected by the sounds around them. Most of these things are familiar to us: noise-canceling headphones, white noise machines, recorded music designed to sound like the great outdoors. Haygood's term for them pays homage to the mythical Orpheus, who fought the bewitching, fatal songs of the sirens by pulling out his lyre and playing music of his own. Today's Orphic tools may not aspire to the great prophet's standard of beauty, but they carry this original impulse to combat the sounds of others. During the last 40 years, the advent of the personal listening device has given us the capacity to change our soundscapes at a whim. Early media theorists described this as, quote-unquote, the Walkman effect. As users began to feel more ownership and power as they moved through their daily lives, contemporary scholars have begun pondering what are the consequences of using technology to assist in the quest for confidence or serenity. How do we use sound to control our moods? Could it be that what we're really after is the feeling of control itself? Noise, as Haygood reminds us, is in the ear of the perceiver, and yet we also think of it as an objective threshold, a kind of sonic excess of nonsense or hazard, something that not only bothers us, but presumably bothers everyone else too. Haygood points out that we now often talk about personal freedom in terms of what we don't have to listen to, and he focuses in the book on our efforts to navigate sonic nuances. And although the paradox of combating sound with more sound in a world that has become loud enough to damage our health, rather than freeing us from our anxieties, noise-canceling devices provide only a temporary buffer, and they bring us deeper into dependency on the technologies or networks that may have seemed overwhelming to begin with. Consider, for instance, the Marpac Dome sound machine, a fan in a circular box that will be familiar to many who like to be soothed to sleep by the whirl of a fan. And in the early 60s, a whirring fan represented an unwanted industrial byproduct, the superfluous sound of machines needing to be cooled down. American industrialization throughout the 20th century meant the spread of noise everywhere. Once Marpac recognized that people actually wanted a sonic distraction from this basic feature of modern life, they began marketing the device for improved sleep or concentration. Haygood notes the irony of selling noise back to consumers in the form of this low hum with roots in 20th century industry. The sound of productivity had become inescapable. The most absorbing part of Hush, the book, is about tinnitus, an insistent ringing that is familiar to many who still feel the after effects of a loud concert the morning after. For chronic sufferers, the sound persists irrespective of external stimuli, an unpredictable and unwelcome intrusion to daily life. Haygood details the efforts of researchers who are trying to record the sound of tinnitus in order to help treat it among sufferers, a different, more specialized application of the orphic impulse. And he writes movingly about listening to tinnitus and hearing it as a loss of silence, a loss of choice, and finally, as a loss of self. Even if headphones offer only an illusion of freedom or of control, it's an illusion that clearly appeals to many. What's wrong with the desire for a sonic safe space, even if it requires us to buy or download more things? But once you begin to think about the relationship between the sound waves that constantly pass through us and the potential loss of self, you become more attuned to all the beckoning noises of modern life, all the chill playlists, the meditation apps, the calming coffee shop soundtracks, and the upbeat background music at shopping malls. The constant efforts to sonically sculpt our emotional realities. In Hush, Haygood argues that truly listening to things we would rather ignore is a way of reckoning with the disquiet around us. What we think of as quiet is, like our idea of noise, subjective. True silence of the sort that one finds in Microsoft's echo-free chamber might drive us mad. Sound, after all, is a form of community, a physical force that passes through us. Even if we try to shut our ears, it binds and connects us, even if we don't hear it. The Police with Sting. Every Breath You Take introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article entitled Sting, My Songs. Rock. Sting's second album to mine the past does so conventionally. Unlike 2010's Symphonicities, there's no orchestra here, but also successfully. He recasts the Police brassy 1981 cut Demolition Man as a riffed-out beast and beefs up his 1985 solo hit If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free with an irresistible club-ready bass line. This came out May 24th. I'll be watching you. The Preservation Hall Jazz Band performing Tailgate Ramble introduces our local music news. It's an article written by Ed Condren in the News and Observer on the 24th of May, 2019, entitled, For Raleigh Jazz Band, There's No Place Like Home. Raleigh is home for Peter Lamb. I love it here, Lamb says in an interview, calling from his Flying Squirrel music shop in Raleigh. Lamb tried to lay down roots on Broadway. It didn't work out. I moved to New York right after college, Lamb recalls. I moved out there just before 9/11 happened. I'll never forget waking up that morning at 10 a.m., since I was working as a musician and a bartender. It was surreal. It looked like it was snowing over Manhattan, but it was a clear blue sky. I left New York to come back to Raleigh in November. It was just too depressing living there. Lamb, who attended East Carolina University, was happy to return to Raleigh, where he's been ever since. "Everything is here for me," Lamb says. "A friend told me that Austin is the number one city in the country for work for musicians, and Raleigh is number two. I believe it. I'm always working." The saxophonist who initially moved to Raleigh when he was 8 years old and his band, the Wolves, performed 29th of May at Cocobooth Amphitheater in Cary. They've played numerous gigs at Humble Pie over the last decade, as well as at the Hopscotch Music Festival and an array of clubs throughout the Triangle. "We're in demand around here, and because of that, it's sustainable for us," Lamb says. "We don't have to move away. People like what we do." The group, which delivers New Orleans-style jazz with some R&B tossed in for good measure, is fun live. Lamb can't stand still, and he and the rest of the band feed off the energy of the audience. "It's just fun every time we step on the stage," Lamb says. "We get to play out and make music." The article skips down and ends with this. Lamb, who grew up in Five Points and Raleigh and is a graduate of Broughton High School, doesn't have plans to leave Raleigh. "I just built a chicken coop there, and I'm 2 miles from the shop," Lamb says. "There's no place like it here. I'm sticking around." So, how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, what is the name of the special tuba used by many marching bands today? Is it A, the sackbut, that's spelled S-A-C-B-U-T-T, by the way? Is it the mellophone? Is it C, the sousaphone? Or D, the labrosone? And that is spelled L-A-B-R-O-S-O-N-E. And the correct answer is... answer C, sousaphone. Because traditional tubas are difficult to walk with, many marching bands use a sousaphone, a specialized tuba that fits around the body of the musician, which was named for famed march composer John Philip Sousa, who made several requests and suggestions for its design. Actually, answer A, the sackbut, is the name for the trombone in Renaissance France. And answer B, mellophone, is a French horn-like instrument. And answer D, labrosone, is the term given to all lip-vibrated instruments, including all variations of the tuba. As noted by Anna Green in a 11-20-2015 article in mentalfloss.com titled 12 Metallic Facts About Brass Instruments, brass instruments have been around in one form or another for thousands of years. They've played a part in historical military campaigns, religious ceremonies, and, of course, the development of music around the world. Dedicated to marching band players, jazz fanatics, classical music buffs, and music lovers everywhere, here are four fascinating facts about brass instruments. 1. All brass instruments produce sound through the vibration of the player's lips. Musicians alter their pitch by vibrating their lips at different speeds into the instrument's mouthpiece. 2. Not all instruments in the brass family are made of brass. Instruments like conch shells and shofars, made of hollowed-out animal horns, are still considered brass because they produce sound through lip vibration. 3. Metal trumpets date back to around 1500 BCE, and silver and bronze trumpets have been found in ancient Egyptian graves, and ancient versions of the instrument have also been found in Asia, South America, and Scandinavia. And 4. Trumpets may not be as imposing as the tuba or the trombone, but if you stretched out all the tightly packed metal tubing that makes up the instrument, it would reach an impressive 6.5 feet. Trumpets, 6.5 feet of tubing. And the answer to our second question, the popular marching band trombone suicide routine is named for what? Is it A, its tendency to cause injuries when performed? B, the high-strutting majorette who died of heat exhaustion during its execution. C, the suspicious death of the composer of this song, who had severe depression. Or was it D, it's sarcastic, since the actual routine only involves marching in place for a minute? Correct answer. Answer A. In the routine, a line of trombone players bends and stands in time to a drum beat, so that one player's trombone is where a neighboring player's head was moments earlier. Players who get the timing wrong in practice often end up with a broken nose or a black eye, which is how the routine got to be known as trombone suicide. It's also been called a head chop, for obvious reason. So let's close out today's program with a musical tribute to La Brassons in general and to our march composer, John Philip Sousa, for whom the marching tuba, the sousaphone, is named, with Sousa's The Washington Post March. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review, and as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me. Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.